Hey, welcome along. This is Mark Stein and another Clubland Q&A live around the planet in which I answer questions from Mark Stein Club members from Cook County, Illinois to the Cook Islands in the Pacific. So if you have a question, go to the Stein Online homepage. You'll see our Live Across the Planet Clubland Q&A piece. And post your question there, and I will do my best to get to it. We were celebrating on Sunday the Royal Air Force's 100th birthday, founded April 1st, 1918. And I mentioned that the great South African, sometimes South African Prime Minister, Field Marshal Smuts, was really the guy who, more than any other individual, was responsible for establishing an air force as a separate wing of a military, as distinct from the navy and the army. That was his idea, and he was a member of the Imperial War Cabinet in 1918, and his opinion prevailed in that war cabinet, and the Royal Air Force was set up on April 1st, 1918. And I happen to mention that he was the only South African to have a statue in Parliament Square at Westminster until Nelson Mandela. And that Mandela, in fact, when he was at school, when he was a schoolboy, Smuts came to visit his school. So Mandela and Smuts, in fact, met when Mandela was a teenager. And I was thinking about that yesterday when the news came that Winnie Mandela had died. Winnie Mandela was a truly horrific woman, implicated in all kinds of murder and violence, way beyond even the norms of revolutionary movements. She was the one who said, "We will come to victory with our necklaces," by which she meant the tire that was put around people's heads and then set alight, which was her way of dealing with her enemies. And in fact, she wound up standing trial for the murder of Stompy Mckechtsy, a 14-year-old boy who made the mistake of crossing her. And I often think Winnie Mandela, I always find depressing because they used to name council, blocks of council flats in London after her. So you'd be in some dreary part of the East End and see some hideous concrete monstrosity, and it would be called Winnie Mandela House. After she was put on trial for murder, they didn't bother renaming all those ugly blocks of council flats that were called Winnie Mandela House. But they didn't actually, they ceased naming any new ones after her. So she has fewer physical memorials than she might have expected at one point. But I find Winnie Mandela interesting. You know, Nelson Mandela is the great man. Everyone remembers his funeral a couple of years ago when Obama and David Cameron were doing selfies with the Danish pastry. What was her name? The haughty Danish prime minister, Helga Thorning-Schmidt. And Cameron and Obama were sitting side by side by either side of Helle Thorning-Schmidt, the Danish pastry who was serving as Denmark's prime minister. And they were having all these sort of increasingly giggly school yard selfies during the more somber parts of the Nelson Mandela service, until eventually Michelle tapped Barack on the shoulder and inserted herself between Obama and the fetching Danish Prime Minister. But Winnie Mandela, Nelson Mandela succeeded F.W. de Klerk as the last white leader of South Africa. And these are two great men. F.W. de Klerk isn't as famous as Nelson Mandela because he was the last white leader of a discredited regime. But he was a generous man who understood that regime could not be preserved. And I often think about, as I think I said at the time Mandela died, that de Klerk and Mandela, as great as they are, they do not really symbolize the new South Africa quite as well as their respective wives do. Winnie Mandela, as I've just said, was a murderer. She was a murderer. I've been listening to some of these reports on the BBC and elsewhere, oh, she was a complicated person, has to be understood in the context of her times. Well, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission found her personally responsible for multiple murders in South Africa. So she was a murderer. And Marika de Klerk, F.W. de Klerk's wife, wound up getting murdered. She was found stabbed and strangled in 2001 by a domestic servant. And the statistical odds, if you think of it in American terms, the statistical odds of successive first ladies getting murdered and then being a murderer is utterly insane. But even if you go back to the old South Africa's days when General Smuts was prime minister, it would have been inconceivable to have the idea of a prime ministerial consort either being murdered or being a murderer. Because in Smuts's day, South Africa thought of itself as a functioning first world society. And to see what has become of it, I mean, the murder of F.W. de Klerk's wife wasn't a big deal. It was just one of, I think it was 50 murders a day. No motive, nothing was taken. She was just killed because that's what happens to a certain number of prosperous people or not terribly prosperous people in the course of a typical day in South Africa. I think it's up to, it may even be up to 75 a day now. It's certainly higher than it was then. And so Winnie Mandela's death reminds me that not just of her passing, but of her predecessor as the leader's wife who was stabbed and murdered. And as I said, in Smuts's day, because we were talking about Smuts with regard to the Royal Air Force, that would have been an extraordinary turn of events. Okay, so I wanted to note the passing of Winnie Mandela. We will get to some of your questions. Oh, here's a we can't beat this for a first question from David Geiler, who says, I prefer to read rather than listen. Why doesn't it exist in some readable form? Well, it doesn't exist in a readable form because I haven't said it yet. It's live now. Here I am talking now. So you can't read it because there's nothing to read yet because I haven't said it yet. I'll be saying some more after I get to the end of this sentence. But I haven't said it yet, so you can't read it. You can't have a transcript for something that hasn't yet been said. But you're welcome to, David, to type as you listen to it. And then if you actually transcribe it as I'm saying it, then you can read it as I'm saying it. And that will be nearest as you can get to a live transcript as it's going along. Okay, thank you for that, I think, David. Chris Hall says, I find that the removal of the William McKinley statue rather sad. This is the statue in a Northern California town that I was talking about with Tucker Carlson last night and I wrote about a few weeks ago. They're deciding to take the statue of President McKinley down. Chris Hall says he founds it sad. He's a former Torontonian, as I am, and he says, I remember we always like to make fun of Buffalo, which is something Torontonians like to do with its frequent fires and oddly named suburbs, Tonawanda and Lackawanna and all those ones. But at least they had two historical achievements. Millard Fillmore, possibly the most forgettable of all presidents, and the assassination of McKinley, that's right, at the big exposition in Buffalo, and a big World's Fair type deal that was going on there. And and he was assassinated by Chogosh, the anarchist and immigrant. Now they're just stuck with Fillmore. I guess the youth, and he points out that McKinley had Theodore Roosevelt as vice president, which should have raised his profile among the progressive set. However, TR was definitely more of an imperialistic expansionist. And I guess the youths of today don't know any history at all. Sad. The one thing I always like about Chogosh and the assassination of McKinley, I wasn't thrilled that he was assassinated. But I like the way that happened. I believe that happened like around September the 8th, 9th, something like that, in 1900. And Chogosh, who did it, They fried him by the end of October. It was like 6 weeks, soup to nuts. He shoots McKinley early September. They fried Czolgosz by late October. And that was when America had energy and even its court system could do something in a timely fashion. Now, if you run a stoplight, there'll be months and months and months of scheduling conferences and trial, pre-trial hearings and all the rest of it before you can't do anything. The idea being committing the crime and being fried for it within 6 weeks. Boy, those were the days. I say that as someone who's been in the DC Superior Court now since the year 2012. So I wish I had checked the express service box that Czolgosz did after he shot McKinley. But as you say, Chris, nobody knows nothing. They don't know, and they don't care about, they don't know who McKinley is. He's a white man whose statue stands in their town. They don't know who Theodore Roosevelt is, and they don't really care about policies. It's all got to go. It's all got to go. Because the point about it is that the arrogance of the hyper present, saying that the past is almost by definition bad and wicked compared to us. We are virtuous, and all who came before aren't. And I said to Tucker, it's not really about McKinley, it's about the America that made McKinley president. That's what you're toppling. That's really what you're toppling. You're not just removing a statue of one man. You're removing the culture and the society that voted for him and made him president. So that, for example, in this little rinky-dink town in California, they're not just disrespecting McKinley. They're actually demolishing their own past as a society. And that's the purpose, to reset the clock at year zero, to deny the great historical continuity of America. And you see this in almost, you see this in other societies, you see this in Canada, where they want to take Sir John A. Macdonald's name off pubs and schools and all the rest of it. You see it down in Australia. You see it in Europe. The point is that in non-revolutionary societies that have had centuries of continuous constitutional democratic evolution, the leftist impulse is to destroy all that. And the way to destroy all that is to taint the past, to make the past dirty, to say we cannot have these reminders of the past because the past is dirty and tainted, and therefore to have a continuous, constitutional, peaceful, democratic, evolving past, in fact, taints us. And that's why it's all got to go. Michael Covino, on the subject of that McKinley statue, says, based on his policies to the indigenous people, to remove it is a pathetic rationale. As Tucker noted just prior to your appearance last night, shouldn't we be tearing down the monument in D.C. to FDR, since he ordered the internment of 120,000 Japanese Americans after Pearl Harbor without any due process? Yeah, and you're absolutely right. There's no beginning and end to this. And the fact is as well that when you're talking about men who are all flawed, none of us is without sin, because to be human is to be born, to be created, and to live as a flawed individual. And we are all flawed. And we take men and women and anybody in the fullness of their lives and in the totality of their lives. And I don't like Franklin Roosevelt, and I certainly don't like four-term U.S. presidents. But the fact is that the presidents of the United States, the minute you start actually saying that these guys are elected heads of state, and we cannot have statues of them, then you're actually making any kind of agreed historical past impossible. And it's the old Orwell line. He who controls the present controls the past. He who controls the past controls the future. The old George Orwell line. And what he means by that is that, for example, as we see with McKinley, that some leftist council in Northern California controls the past. And therefore, they control the future in the sense that the residents of that town and in others will grow up in a de-McKinley-fied America. And it won't be the end of it there. I mentioned Rich Lowry, my old boss at National Review, and he was on Fox News, and he said, don't worry, we're not really interested in defending Jefferson Davis and Robert E. Lee and all these other fellows, but when it comes to Lincoln and Jefferson and Washington, we're going to be right there holding the line at that. I don't think so. I don't think so. I think when you can have, once you get used to one, I mean, a lot of presidents aren't very good. You know, Franklin Pierce, the only New Hampshire president, was a stinker of a president. Does that mean there should be no memorials of a man who is president of the United States? No. He should be there and in the roll call along with everybody else. But it gets difficult. The minute you say, oh, this president, we can tear down his statue, and that president, we can tear down his statue. But don't you worry. No, don't worry. We're going to make sure, George Washington, Lincoln, probably not Lincoln because he suspended habeas corpus, but George Washington, yeah, okay, father of our country, we'll hold the line at him. I'll believe that when I see it. Right now, the line keeps getting moved, as it always does, because no concession to the vandals is ever enough. Ronald Dahlgren writes, besides the option that President Trump mobilize the National Guard or reserves of California and Texas and fly the Honduran marchers back, we ought to take seriously these subversives as the mobs they are. Lincoln addressed the threat to our republic in his remarkable address, The Perpetuation of Our Political Institutions, when he powerfully identified the internal danger of mobocracy to the ordered procedures of our republic. It is the mark of the republic to determine citizenship and migration procedures, and it is an attack to break in and push to the front of the line. You're right on that, Ronald. I think, though, we live actually in the opposite of mobocracy to a certain extent, in that it's actually these things are obvious provocations to the lawful population of the United States of America. And yet the lawful population of the United States of America puts up with it. I mean, mobocracy, in the sense of a mob in the street demanding this and that, whatever the deficiencies of that, they're generally your own mob. If you're in Ireland and there's a mob in the street, it's an Irish mob. If you're in France and there's a mob in the street, it's a French mob. There is something bizarre about the moment we are living in. It's a moment when we're told by people that we have to bring all these undocumented, these fine members, fine upstanding members of the undocumented American community out of the shadows. They're actually well out of the shadows. They're in the streets protesting, demanding rights. People who shouldn't be in the country are in the streets demanding rights. They're on the television demanding rights. They're in the newspapers demanding rights. And we have here now a cavalcade marching through Mexico, coming to the United States border, telling us they haven't got here yet and they're already demanding rights. And the people who support them, what was interesting to me is some of the little clips that Tucker Carlson played on the show last night. Tucker played these clips, people saying, oh, why are all these white racists scared of brown people? There's just some, you know, there's just these people marching on the country and saying they're coming in and they're not going to be showing their passports and they're not going to be standing. And the idea they have, why they have these caravans, is so they can overwhelm the border post they choose to cross at by their sheer numbers. And you have these clever lefties saying, oh, why are all these white supremacists so scared of a few brown people? It's nothing to do with that. It would be wrong if it were a caravan of Canadians marching down to cross the 49th parallel. A nation is its people, and a people is its nation. And the minute those circles no longer overlap, you don't have a nation. I mean, basically, if you're saying that anyone who gets here can be an American, then there isn't an America, is there? What's the point of it? Then it's just like a sort of big old parking lot, and it's just a question of who gets in there and fills it up first. And that's actually the situation we're in. And it's particularly I want to emphasize a point I made with Tucker, that it's absolutely absurd that half these people who are here illegally came here since 9/11, when every American, every law-abiding person has lived with this orange alert nonsense, which is the default setting. And then once in a while, when a bomb goes off somewhere or some crazy does something, they kick it up to red alert. But basically, orange alert is the default setting. That's why you shuffle shoeless through American airports until the end of time. That's why you have the old TSA putting on their latex gloves and poking around in your underwear, because we're on orange alert. That's why your kid can't buy a snow globe, as I attempted to do for my daughter at a New Zealand airport, and the cashier said, "Oh, are you going to America? Oh, sorry, you can't take snow globes from America. I can't even have..." So we've got such a crack security regime that a snow globe can't be taken on a plane, and yet when 1,200 Hondurans decide they just want to walk into the country, nothing can be done to stop them. These two things don't go together. You either have open borders or you have orange alert. But to have open borders on orange alert means we're living in a world where we're living in what I often call a bifurcated society, where there are some people who are law-abiding. And so they're chastised in ever more absurd and trivial ways at every moment of the day. And there's another group of people who say, "Screw your laws, we don't believe in any of these laws." And the state just says, "Oh, okay, then fine. Feel free to march into the country. You don't have any paperwork? That doesn't matter. We'll give you a fakey social security number, and we'll give you a driver's license, and you should be all set." And these two things, orange alert America and open borders America, you should be able to have one or the other. But what's interesting to me, particularly on the Republican side, is you have fellas like Lindsey Graham who believe in both. The justification, when you listen to Lindsey Graham, for example, talk about the need for the high-tech security state, the NSA need to be in your grandma's emails and going through everything, because we're in a war on terror, and so we got to do this and we got to do that, and we got to have unlimited resources for the big high-tech 24/7 security state, says Lindsey Graham. The same Lindsey Graham who says, "Oh yeah, open borders, come on down." You can't have it both ways. I read a terribly sad story about Easter at major Christian churches in Manhattan, where they now have to have metal detectors at churches in New York, because we got no metal detectors at the border. Because as I always say, if you don't have a security perimeter around your national border, you have to have a security perimeter around every little thing inside the border, including individual churches. Rich writes, "Hi, Mark. Love the Q&A. Professor Robert George at Princeton presented a thought-provoking tweet a while back. Every statue of a slaveholder should cause us to reflect on the question, to which grave evils of our own time am I blind or desensitized? The left is more than willing to eat their predecessors when it advances present-day causes, most notably slavery, which has been expunged from the history of the Democrats. Looking ahead one, two decades or beyond, what do you think will be the big issues future generations of liberals scrub from contemporary liberals?" Well, first of all, just to address that bit about you saying that slavery has been expunged from the history of the Democrats. That's right. All these guys whose statues in the Confederacy we're arguing about, they're all Democrats. The Democrat Party of the 19th century was the biggest slave-supporting, most powerful slave-supporting institution on the planet. And what's incredible is that it survived to the present day. I mean, I mentioned South Africa at the top of the show, and the old South African National Party, which was the apartheid party that came to power after Smuts in 1948 and instituted the apartheid regime for the next 45 years or whatever it was. And in the new South Africa, the National Party was felt to be tainted by the stench of apartheid. So eventually they changed their name and they merged with this or that and they did something else. And I forget, they sort of have a residual rump of them surviving in some fashion or other, but they're not called the National Party anymore. The Democrat Party, the biggest slave-owning institution, slave-supporting institution on the planet in the 19th century, is the only one to have survived till the 21st. Professor George's line is sobering to me because it is actually what... It's actually true. If you see a statue of a flawed man, whether he holds slaves or anything else, what it generally means is a man who was in tune with his times and is now out of sorts with his times, because Jefferson Davis supported slavery. Columbus arrived and he seized the continent from Native Americans or the Indians or whatever you meant to call them now. So Jefferson Davis was on the wrong side of slavery. Columbus was on the wrong sides of indigenous people's rights. George Washington, I've no idea what his view of transgender bathrooms was, but I'm sure it isn't the correct one. And instead of punishing the past, instead of punishing William McKinley because he is a man of the late 19th century, the fact that he falls short judging him by our time should, as Professor George says, condition us to think how we will fall short in a generation or two's time. And you don't even have to go but far. You know, as has been mentioned, Franklin Roosevelt, great progressive Democrat, big government, basically the big government state that is drowning us in debt and all the regulatory agencies, that's all Franklin Roosevelt. He was the biggest advance for big government in the history of the United States, and the left love him for that. But even though that's within living memory, he's a flawed man because he put all these Japanese folks in internment camps. And that should alert us to how quickly the fashions can change. You don't actually need to go back that far. You know, Obama and Hillary were opposed to gay marriage a decade ago and all the rest of it, supposedly, officially. But it's where I think the question goes wrong, and it's an interesting question from Rich, but I think it's slightly wrong in this point of view, because I think we're actually going to be seeing a reaction. For example, we think of social, as I say, in America alone, we think of social progress at like technological progress. You know, you have the wheel. Someone invents the wheel, so then someone invents the cart, and eventually someone invents a train, and then an automobile, and then a plane. And you can't uninvent the wheel or uninvent the internal combustion engine. But you can uninvent certain progressive rights, for example. So we may think everything is just going to get, look, the, you know, LGBTQ, we may think it's just going to be all LGBT QWERTY. We're going to work our way through the great big alphabet soup of sexual identities. And then people who weren't quite on the cutting edge will look as bad as McKinley does in a century's time. But I don't believe it's actually going to go like that. I think you already see, for example, in the de-gaying, a sort of, there's a kind of equivalent, there's a sort of gay equivalent of ethnic cleansing going on in the East End of London since all the Muslims moved in there. It's like orientational cleansing. You've got gay bars and pubs closing down. Same thing in Amsterdam. And I think actually that's going to be the way of the future, that that in, say, 30 or 40 years' time, this is actually going to be a, in terms of those kind of identities, this is going to be a much more repressive society. And it will be interesting to me whether America can remain immune from that trend, because it's certainly not in as pathetic and decrepit a state as the United Kingdom and Europe are on that front. But whether it can remain entirely immune, I think, is rather doubtful. Joseph Dornish says, do you still have much contact with any of the people you used to work with from National Review? What do you make of the rampant never-Trumpism there? It seems to me that while Trump is not Goldwater or Reagan-esque, he is governed more to the right than either Bush. For example, I do not believe that either Bush would have dumped the Paris Climate Agreement. Well, I would agree with you on that, Joseph. And I think particularly, and here's my problem with the Never Trumpers, and they're not as bad at National Review, in fairness, as Bill Kristol and his chums at the Weekly Standard were. I think it was clear and perfectly obvious that the Bush-era Republicanism, and I liked George W. Bush, and I'm glad he was there on September 11th rather than the alternative. But I think there's no doubt that in the among the Republican Party base, Bush-style Republicanism did not speak to millions and millions of Republican voters. I would say as well that it was also objectively a failure, not necessarily because of Bush, but because of what happened after that first flush of energy after 9/11. We're running around Afghanistan still now, coming up to 17 years, America's longest war. It's an unwon war. As I always say, 24 hours after the last Western soldier leaves Afghanistan, it will be as if we were never there. Nobody can identify what the war aims are in Afghanistan. Nobody thought it was going to be like that. And in a sense, that's something that Bill Kristol and the Never Trumpers ought to ask themselves. Why is it the Republican base didn't want a Republican Party that stands for endless unwon war? Now, I'm quite a martial fellow. I'm a great believer in invading countries and making the peasant populations miserable. I'm all for doing that. But when you're actually just dithering around pointlessly for no discernible strategic purpose, then you can't be surprised when people start thinking, well, wait a minute, what's in this for me? What is the Republican Party offering me? And I think there's no doubt that people, that the base felt that the Bush-era Republicanism didn't offer them anything, actually was irrelevant to most of their lives. And you saw this in some of the odder moments during some of the Republican debates when you had sort of people anxious to invade Russia. I mean, for a start, you know, it's not a good idea to for a start, the failures of the post 9/11 era ought to occasion a certain circumspection among Bush era Republicanism, you know. I seriously think the whole way of war, American way of war, needs completely revisiting. The Pentagon needs complete remodeling and rethinking. And the purpose of the nation's military needs a kind of re-examination too. But the fact is, it didn't speak to people. I mean, people, when you looked at what Marco Rubio and Jeb Bush and some of these others were offering, it just wasn't there. And I think that's where the never Trumpers don't understand that they're the reason we wound up with Trump. They're the reason we wound up with Trump. Trump didn't sort of just emerge and then they figured we have to organize and resist Trump. Trump actually emerged as the alternative to you. And that is something that I don't think they've given enough thought to. Raj S. Rajendra. I think Raj is short for Rajendra, is that right? I think so. I ought to know that. I believe it is. Anyway, Rajendra, or Raj. Raj says, hello, Mark. I'm not able to move beyond Cold War-era music. With all the technology at disposal, not a single contemporary band is able to match Pink Floyd, even on the technology front. My musical question of the day is, do you find contemporary music across genres inspirational in the least, if not original? I couldn't honestly say that I do, Raj. I always like it when rock and roll guys get into the start sounding like their parents. If you like Glenn Miller and you come home and your teenager's playing the Rolling Stones and you're thinking, oh God, this isn't music. I always like it when the rock guys start doing that, when people start saying, oh, you know, say what you like about Miley Cyrus, but she's no Debbie Boone, and those kind of cyclical conversations. It's very important to try and actually pick out what's going on other than that. I think what the whole nature of the music business has changed, so that if you looked at it at the sort of height of the 70s or 80s, when you used to have super producers and people used to fly to top-notch recording studios, you know, whether it was Muscle Shoals or wherever it was in, where's the one in Switzerland there, where they did the that Smoke on the Water, Montreux or wherever it was, and they'd all hold up and they'd be there with producers remixing and doing all this kind of thing. And it would be a whole big palaver, as they say. And now you don't really have that. And everything's I'm amazed sometimes when you listen to how stripped down the music is, because it's not acoustic. It's not like MTV Unplugged, where somebody's had a big wall of sound production and then they're just standing there with an acoustic guitar doing it. It's still a technical, computer-driven sound, but it's like a simple computer sound. And to my ears, it sounds like we are at the end of something. It sounds exhausted. It feels exhausted. And I'm being very careful about that. But I think it may be that means that something new is about to come along, or it may simply mean that the way we deliver music in the modern era works against the kind of melodic or harmonic creation that was present a century ago. And I think that has something to do with it, that if music is something you make on your computer in your home and then other people listen to it on a little device with earbuds, you make a different kind of music than you would if you go back to the 1880s or 1890s, when music is a communal thing. And either you go to some local hall to hear it, or everyone gathers around the old Joanna in your front parlor and somebody plays the piano and somebody else accompanies them on the violin. And so because we've changed, I think that is as much to do with it as anything else. Toby Pilling writes, having hate crimes on the statute book actually promotes hatred, fragmenting society by encouraging competition between victim groups, unbalancing the scales of justice, and suppressing free speech. Would you agree? Absolutely. The purpose of hate crimes is to enable a bureaucracy that gets to mediate between competing groups. So that the minute you have hate, and this is why the stupidity of conservative governments and right of centre governments and going along with it is incredible, because it's a big government activity. The minute you actually start saying, we know how big government is, for example, when you say, when you have a minimalist government, when you say the government has to regulate customs and tariffs at ports of entry into your country. And you think, oh, okay, that sounds the sort of thing a government should do. What does that involve? Well, it involves a bureaucracy that comes and looks after all that. Oh, right. Well, the minute you have hate crimes and hate speech, then you are going to have a bureaucracy that will administer that. And because it's an essentially subjective thing, that bureaucracy isn't going to be like the bureaucracy that administers Her Majesty's customs at this or that port. It's going to be a lot more capricious and whimsical. And so it's not just that it sets groups against one another, but it, by definition, it increases the power of government as the only legitimate arbiter of relations between those groups. Lawrence Brennan writes, have you any thoughts on the recent passing of Peter Monk? Peter, for those who didn't know him, Peter was the founder of Barrack Gold. Did I say Barrack? Which is one of the biggest, it's like a hugely successful enterprise. He became a gazillionaire, and he made more money than most of us could ever dream of, and he gave more money away. As you'll know, if you wander around Toronto and you see his name over certain wards at the Toronto General Hospital and certain departments of the University of Toronto, he gave away billions. And Peter Monk was a Hungarian, Jew. He got out of there towards the end of the Second World War and wound up in Canada. And he loved Canada. And if you're saying monk, where have I heard that word? Well, the monk debates, where I pushed back against Louise Arbour and Simon Sharma, and Nigel Farage and I wound up winning that debate on the migrants and so-called refugees afflicting Europe in 2016. The Monk debate is, again, one of those great gifts that Peter Monk set up and gave to his adopted country, Canada, which he loved. And he got all the baubles of the state that the Canadian state can give him. He was in the Order of Canada, and he got the Queen's Diamond Jubilee Medal and all the rest of it. But he was he gave far more back to Canada than they could ever give to him. And the last time I saw Peter was at a memorial for George Jonas, another Hungarian immigrant to Canada. And George is one of the greatest public intellectuals Canada ever produced, and as a result made very little money out of it, even though he came up with a book that Steven Spielberg turned into a film. I can't remember the ins and outs of that, but anyway, the deal wasn't that carefully done. He didn't make any money out of that. But so Peter, as an incredibly wealthy Hungarian in Canada, basically was the impresario of this wonderful memorial to George Jonas in Toronto. And Peter Monk had an incredible sort of face. It was like a very... I always thought it was a great face, like a face that looked great in close-up. It was very sharp and super defined. And he gave a very amusing speech. And I often think when you hear that term émigré, in a certain sense, Peter Monk was an émigré and George Jonas was an émigré. I always think the word émigré is made for Hungarians. And if you say to me émigré, I think of Hungarians in Paris. It's a word made for Hungarians. They make the best émigrés. And Peter Monk was funny. and charming and delightful, and did a great thing for his fellow Hungarian, George Jonas, at this memorial he threw for him. So I mourn his passing, and I certainly hope the Monk debates, which are one of his many gifts to Canada, will continue. Peter was 90 when he died last week, and he didn't seem like a 90-year-old. He was full of vigor and energy, far more energy than actually a lot of people half his age. Emily Maximov writes, "Hi, Mark. I always have a chuckle when I read the comments on some of your posts. What do you know? You're just an immigrant, or go back to wherever you came from." These comments are, of course, from the pro-illegal immigration and amnesty bunch. It seems futile to point out their hypocrisy because most contentions of the left seem rooted in double standards, whether it's concerning immigration, diversity, or free speech. I wonder if they have reached the point of no return. Even if a liberal were to agree that a caravan of Hondurans ready to invade the country were actually a bad thing, they know they can't disagree without being vilified by their own side. Do you think many of the left are too proud to admit they could be wrong, so they just fight that much harder to the point of being nonsensical? Well, Emily, I don't know that they're too proud to admit that they're wrong. But I think, like, just to take the scenario you've given us, there's this caravan of Hondurans that's coming at slow motion toward the southern border of the United States. And at a certain point, it will arrive. But in a sense, that's like a long-range invasion. If you go back to the Falklands War, when Mrs. Thatcher dispatched that task force from Southampton, and the task force took, I think it was 2 weeks to sail from Southampton to reach the Falklands. And those 2 weeks, the Argentines know that it's getting closer every day, every day, every day, every day. And so the point then is for that to concentrate the mind. They see it coming. It's getting closer. It's getting closer. It's like you're tied to the tracks and the train is approaching and it's coming down the tracks. And you know that sooner or later, it's gonna arrive. That's what this caravan of Hondurans is. There's something, that's an obvious provocation. That's an obvious provocation. But the point is, on the left, you can't be seen to be provoked by it. So even if you have a bit of disquiet about it, and most people on the left don't even think about the implications, because what they mean, to go back to the clips that Tucker Carlson played last night on his show, where they're saying, "Oh, look at all the silly white supremacist Republicans. They're all scared of brown people." Well, I'm not. Look at me. I'm not scared of brown people. Ooh. That's all it's about. They don't think about anything. If some of us think about the numbers of these things. If you take the population of North America, Europe, Australia, Japan, it comes to about 1 billion people. The developed world is 1 billion people. And that leaves about 6 billion people in the rest of the world. So it would only require a sixth of the rest of the world to move to North America, Europe, Australia and New Zealand, because Japan doesn't want any immigrants. So you can count Japan out. So it would only require a sixth of the 6 billion people in the rest of the world to move to the developed world, and there would be no more developed world. Basically, we would be very easily suddenly find ourselves in societies where nothing worked, where everything was corrupt, where life was cheap, and all the rest of it. But the modern left doesn't look at it like that. They say, if you were even to put it in those hard numbers, well, what's so wrong? Are you scared of brown people? I'm not scared of brown people. I'm not scared of 1,200 Hondurans, and I wouldn't be scared. I wouldn't be scared of 1 billion Hondurans. You're a racist if you are. And because it's all about virtue signaling, it's all an act of moral vanity. But at the same time, it's very rigorously policed. And it's an all-or-nothing package on the left these days. So they've decided that this Honduran caravan is a good thing, and that if you object to it, you're a white supremacist, right? I was denounced as a white supremacist because I came out against the Honduran caravan on Tucker Carlson last night. So I'm a white supremacist because I think that nations should be nations of laws, and that if people want to emigrate to the United States, they should go to their local consulate and fill in the paperwork. But instead, these people are just walking into the country. And the left has decided that if you're opposed to caravans of Hondurans walking into the country, you're a racist. And so if you're on the left and you're beginning to feel a bit squeamish about this, you can't be a little bit left. It's a bit like being a little bit pregnant. You can't do that. You've got to be you're in for the whole deal. You're signed up for the whole package. And they know, because they see sometimes what happens to very famous people who make one infelicitous tweet. They know what happens if you step out of line on that. So I don't think it's that they're too proud to admit they're wrong. I think they're actually fearful of being admitted they're wrong. And this is actually the danger with leftist thought police. I mentioned in Monday's column this lady in the United Kingdom who the police are now investigating and have denied the right to leave the country. So she can't go for 2 weeks in the Greek islands or take off to Marbella and do a week of sunbathing or anything, because she's being investigated because she tweeted some disagreement with a pediatric transgender activist. This is if you're, you know, if your six-year-old boy discovers his sister's dolls and likes playing with them. And so the school and the doctor and everyone says, OK, we've got to get him on transitioning into being a girl, and we're going to give him drugs to delay the onset of puberty, and we're going to book him for an operation at which he chop his genitals off. And if you think, well, could we just ease up on that a minute? This lady tweeted a disagreement with this pediatric transgender activist, and as a result, she has lost her freedom of movement. She's not at liberty to leave the country. Say what you like about the Soviets, but when they restricted your freedom of movement, when they didn't let you out of the country, it wasn't because you had a difference of opinion about chopping an 11-year-old's meat and two veg off. So what's happened is this is how fast it moves on the left. 10 years ago, that was still a radical position. And the number of transitioning grade schoolers was so small that, in fact, it made news. There was one down in Australia who made news all around the world because it was so unusual. Goes from 10 years to being a radical position to being the received wisdom of everyone who matters, and then to the next stage where it actually becomes criminal to disagree with it. And everyone understands that the left, when they say celebrate diversity, they mean enforce conformity. That's the point. Celebrate diversity means you think this way and no other. That's the uniformity of diversity. And they're getting more and more serious on that. Jim Anthony writes, please comment on Trump's plan to use the military to stop the, quote, immigrant invasion. I hope he does. I hope he does. I think it's embarrassing. I think the United States is the global hyperpower. If you can just walk in what sense is it a hyperpower? You don't have to be a hyperpower to stop 1,000 Hondurans from walking into your country. I would hope that completely peripheral nations such as Montenegro would be able to do that. I would hope that Finland would be able to do that. I would hope that any functioning first world society would be able to do that. What's happening here? I mean, I think there's something he's hoping to leverage NAFTA to get Mexico to stop them. And I hope that works. But what he's basically saying now is that he is a permanent bureaucracy that is actually at war with the elected government of the United States. If a president, supposedly he's the leader of the free world. The president of the United States is the leader of the free world. He's the most powerful man in the world. The most powerful man in the world is actually tweeting at the moment that America has no borders. America cannot enforce its sovereignty. And Americans should be ashamed at that. That we're reduced to pleading with the government of Mexico to stop these guys before they reach the U.S. border, because once they reach the U.S. border, American immigration law means that we'll take whatever names they give, and then they'll be dispersed into the general population. Because that's the system. And that if any of them, if ever, who knows who's a genuine refugee? I would imagine, as in Europe, the percentage of genuine refugees is tiny, if barely statistically detectable. But what you're doing is incentivizing the whole world to come here. And beyond that, you're basically teaching ISIS or whoever else has got a grudge against you that all you need to do is plant 10, 11, 20 people in the next caravan of Hondurans, and they'll barely be questioned. They'll take their names, and then they'll be put on buses and shipped all around the United States. And that's where your next Pulse nightclub bomber, or your next San Bernardino shooter, or your next Boston Marathon killer will be coming from. The first duty of a sovereign state is to secure its borders. If it can't secure its borders, it's not a sovereign state. It isn't actually very complicated. Joe Patterson writes, today a Dutch attorney became the first victim of the Mueller investigation. He was sentenced to 30 days in jail for basically doing no less than what Hillary and her gang did. Your thoughts? Well, I believe he was actually sentenced because he so-called lied to the FBI. Now, we have the FBI lying to us all the time. We have the deputy director of the FBI, this McCabe guy, who's lied, I think, at least four times. And as I said, I don't believe in this law that if you lie to the FBI, you're looking at 5 years in jail for every time you lie to them. So this guy copped a plea and he's getting 30 days in jail. He shouldn't be getting any time in jail. That law is disgraceful, and this investigation is disgraceful. Here's the story. The story on the whole Mueller investigation is this. The Mueller investigation was set up to distract from the fact, not that the Russians interfered in the US election, but that the permanent bureaucracy of the US government, at the direction of key Obama officials, interfered in the US election, which is banana republic stuff, which means that when those Hondurans cross the border, they'll find they fit in better than they ever thought, at least in respect of that kind of permanent state corruption. Robert Stewart says, wait a minute, no, that's what, oh, Mike says, Mark, how about we just leave the people on our currency as they are and tell the Democrats that they can put their new heroes picture on the IRS tax forms? That's more appropriate anyway. Yeah, I don't like changing people on the currency. I don't like it. There's no good answer to that. In monarchies, it should be the sovereign on the currency, and in republics, you should have people who have been dead a very long time on the currency, and once they're on it, you should leave them there. You shouldn't be, again, that's one of those things that just reflects the fashion of the time and is and is pathetic. It's like changing the names of streets or changing the names of mountains. They took McKinley, he had a Mount McKinley, didn't he, in Alaska, and they took his name off that prior to taking him down in this California time. Robert Stewart writes, Mark, Islam holds a stronger claim to longevity and the support of slavery than does the Democratic Party. That's true. I was meaning in the Western world. I was meaning in the developed world. Yes, it's true that Islam still does a lot of slavery, still does a lot of sex slavery. And I don't just mean in places like Chad and Mali, but in Telford and Rotherham too. Nicola Timmerman writes, what do you think of Canada planning to take in the Africans that Israel is deporting? Yeah, I saw this. Benjamin Netanyahu basically announced that he's got all these illegal Africans there, and he's not a wimp about it like they are in the United States. So he offered them a choice between being kicked out or they were going to be indefinitely detained. And then everybody complained about it. And so he persuaded other first world countries to resettle them. So some of these Africans being deported by Israel are moving to Canada, just as some of those fellows who were being held in Papua New Guinea because they couldn't get into Australia are being resettled in the United States. This isn't anything to do. Actually, let's leave all the white people and brown people thing out of it. I think one of the saddest things these days, when you go around Europe in particular, but almost any other country, is the way multiculturalism makes everything the same, makes everything boring. And I think back to the days of my youth when Sweden was more Swedish and Denmark was more Danish. And Norway was more Norwegian, and Finland was more Finnish. And now everything just seems kind of sad and all the same. And the traffic's one way. It seems ridiculous to me. These are Africans who emigrate to Israel. Israel says, you're here illegally, so we're kicking you out, but we have to kick you out to Canada. There is actually no need. 30% of men are going to be unemployed in a generation with automation. 30% of the planet's men. Nobody needs mass immigration anymore. Unless you think that the best thing for social tranquility is to import more and more and more young men for whom all the jobs are being eliminated by automation. Because having young men with no jobs is such a great recipe for social tranquility. And that big thought looks like where we're leaving it for this time. Fran Lavery writes, I'll tell you what, we ought to end with a bit of a any possibility of including a Thanksgiving or Christmas short story by Truman Capote at year's end, or another of your choosing by Capote? Maybe. I always think of Truman Capote because I always remember Ted Baxter on the Mary Tyler Moore show, and he says, "Oh yeah, it's this book by Truman Capote," and I think Lou Grant says E, so Ted goes, "It's a book by Truman Capote," and Ted and Lou goes E, and he goes, "Oh yeah," says Ted. Truman E. Capote. So we may do a story by Truman E. Capote. Fran, thank you for saying the Tales of Our Time is one of your favourite features of the club. Tom Degnan says, what did your musical education consist of? It's awesome and your depth of knowledge continues to impress. Well, I did do piano lessons and I have played piano very badly at times. Jeff Stevens, who is a wonderful British pop composer, he wrote There's a Kind of Hush All Over the World Tonight and a lot of great stuff like, and what's the Winchester Cathedral, a lot of great big pop hits. And Jeff's a marvelous composer. He can't actually play his own tunes on the piano. And I remember one time when we were actually at a piano doing something, I wound up actually having to play the thing for him, because Jeff is a fairly terrible player of his own tunes. I'm a marginally less bad player, but other than that, most of it is self-taught. But thank you for that question, Tom. And we will take more of your questions next time. Don't forget to get in on this. All you have to do is join the Mark Stein Club. We are always pleased to welcome new members, and we had a little slew of them today, and we're happy to add to the family. And speaking of Tales for Our Time, we will be back with a brand new Tale for Our Time this Friday, and it is an absolute corker. You won't want to miss it. We will see you again next time, live around the planet, for another Clubland Q&A.